Welcome to the podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. My name is Minnie Baragwanath, and this series is based on my book by the same name. Blindingly Obvious is my story. It is a candid and deeply personal story about my life and work as a blind woman, social entrepreneur, and innovator. I wrote it in order to share my experience of blindness with others, and in the hope that it might raise awareness and invite others to actively create a more accessible future, one that is full of possibility. A wonderful voiceover artist and now friend of mine, Romy Hooper, has narrated my full book, all 24 chapters. I do so hope you enjoy listening. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to share it with you.
22. Paying the price. Returning to work in September 2016, a year after I had left, was unbelievably difficult. I was totally changed. I'd been deeply traumatized, and my entire perspective on my life, my work, and, very importantly, how I viewed access had forever been altered. Mum told me she often thought of me and my life as being like an ancient Japanese samurai sword. Over time, the steel and carbon samurai sword is made stronger and stronger by skillfully and artfully placing it back into the unforgiving flames of the fire. This happens repeatedly until the warrior's sword is exceptionally powerful and sharp. However, there are critical moments where, if the conditions are not just right, if the flame is too hot at the wrong moment or something goes wrong, the entire sword can suddenly snap in two. I certainly had been in and out of the flames, and there were many more flaming fires to come. But at this moment, I did not feel strong. I felt fragile and easily broken. The thought plagued me. Did I even belong here at B anymore? Not only had I changed, but of course, so much had also changed at B during my time away. It had to, and the team had done the most remarkable job. I could see they'd done everything they could to keep things moving and to keep B's head above water. It must have been such a terribly tough time for everyone, and it must have taken a huge personal toll. 12 months may not seem a very long time, but in a fast-paced organization like B, 12 months is a lifetime. Walking in on that first day, while many of my beloved original team were still there, I did not recognize many of the other faces in the room. I had not been prepared for that. I felt shy and exposed. Who were these new people? Who were these new members of my team? Was this still my B family? Where had these new people come from? What was my relationship to them? And theirs to me? I felt like a stranger walking into my own home. Then I remember sitting down at my computer, turning it on and waiting for my programs to open. It was like touching a poisoned chalice. Nothing worked. In normal life, pre-cancer and before the inaccessible health system experience I had had, this would have been bad enough. But this time I felt defeated. Our entire computer system had been updated, but it seemed that no one had thought to check how it would affect me, the CEO, the founder of B, and their blind colleague and friend. Of all the things that I had needed in order to come back in and stand any chance of getting back up on my feet, I had needed someone to take care of this for me, or with me. I realized no one knew how, and that was a deeply shocking realization. Was B as inaccessible as any other organization? Had we failed to make it different? Had we spent so much time facing outwards, influencing change out there in society, that we had overlooked much of what was needed internally? Were we the plumber with faulty taps at home? Or the doctor with sick children? Or was something else going on? Perhaps more confronting was the feeling that I had been somehow responsible for this situation, and that I had enabled this to happen. In the early days in particular, we had needed to move unbelievably fast because we were an audacious social enterprise in startup mode. This meant that as the blind CEO, I had often chosen to compromise on and to minimize the things I needed, in order to not slow down the rest of the organization. And yes, to not be difficult or a burden. At the time, I had justified this by telling myself I had sacrificed my own needs for a greater need. I had gone without in order to try and advance a greater width. And of course, I could manage to do this while I was physically well, when I had the additional strength and resources to do so. But over time, this had become deeply unsustainable. Once I got sick, I found myself in an emotional and, yes, physical deficit. While my unreliable computer setup was bad enough, it was not the only thing that I struggled with. So many things were inaccessible to me. So many things were not designed with a blind person in mind, let alone a blind CEO. So 1,000 times a day, many things forced me to improvise just to live my life and do my basic job. Whether it was the fact I could not access our impenetrable CRM, Customer Relationship Management, at work. This contained all the contact details for our partners and key clients and team. Whether it was trying to read and see spreadsheets and budgets. Whether it was trying to go to meetings and realizing that most buildings do not have large street numbers on the side of the building that are readily visible. Whether it was then going inside the building to locate the office where a meeting was being held, only to find that if there was a directory board with all the businesses in that building listed, it was a light board with so much glare it was impossible to read. Whether it was trying to find which lift to get into and then being unable to read the floor numbers. Whether it was being in meetings where people did not introduce themselves at the start, so I had no idea who was in the room and who I was speaking to. Whether it was turning up to give presentations to hundreds of people and finding that the entire setup made it impossible for me to see what I was doing because the organisers had not paid attention to my needs. Whether it was contracting expensive consultants to do pivotal pieces of work, only to be given deeply inaccessible documents I could not read, therefore seriously compromising my ability to make an informed decision. Whether it was going to important dinners and not being able to see what was on my plate and being too embarrassed to ask for help. Whether it was finding at the same dinner table when I had asked to bring a support person that my request had been denied. Or whether, when I was trying to host an important meeting where a $1 million contract was at stake, as it was too difficult for me to see to pour the tea and coffee for my guests, asking for assistance and the staff person I asked walking out because they felt this task was below them. Or whether it was the fact that we had generally failed to build the true cost of overcoming an inaccessible world into our organisation. Certainly our funders and our partners had also never thought to build this in, and in fact most actively resisted any conversation to address this inequity. The fact was that I now had to travel business class if I flew overseas, due to my high risk of dying from blood clots. My doctor had told me it was critical I lie down on long-haul trips. I now ideally also needed an assistant with me on local trips to overcome some of the access issues. But this also increased our costs. I even used much of my own personal access support fund to offset costs at B, because I felt so guilty, asking to have these additional costs paid for. We were never reimbursed for these additional expenses. The true costs of offsetting an inaccessible world and ensuring access, B had to pay. But now, B was itself in deficit. To this day, I struggle to find the best words to describe what happens when critical moments of social change are taking place. But one phrase that comes to mind is collateral damage. This is a term that often gets thrown around in the context of war or going to battle. The idea is that there is and always will be a degree of damage that occurs in the interest of advancing a greater good or a greater outcome of some sort. Unless someone is prepared to be that collateral damage and to be of service or to be sacrificed, nothing ever changes. Perhaps another way to think about this is to apply the metaphor of shock absorbers in a car, or perhaps taking one for the team. I now clearly see that in many ways, B, were sucking up the shock and the inequity of an inaccessible world. And of course, the critical question here is, could we have made the progress we did without such sacrifice? Could we have ensured that more than 150 access leaders got to participate in a world-class, year-long, life-changing leadership program that built a powerful community and network of access leaders for the future? Could we have placed hundreds of incredibly talented access citizens into meaningful employment and refuse to accept the tyranny of low expectations so many employers still hold? Could we have worked with hundreds of organizations, tourism providers, hoteliers, sports organizations, councils, shopping malls, universities, and so on, and supported them on their journey to become increasingly accessible? Could we have generated endless stories in the media about access and the vision for an accessible Aotearoa? Could we have disrupted not only the regressive attitudes of mainstream society, but also, at times, a very old-fashioned charity-minded disability sector? Could we have infused the access conversation with a degree of positivity and vibrancy that it had been deeply lacking? No, I do not think so. The sobering truth is that I think it had been the only way at the time. But several years into B's life, it was not possible for us to continue in that way. Almost the same week I came back to work, we were given 1 month's notice on our wonderful office space in the CBD. We had less than a month to now find a truly glorious space that could hold us, contain us, and enable us to flourish, or at least be vaguely accessible for the entire diverse team. What a mission. It was extraordinary facing the reality that in 2016, it was still almost impossible to find a truly accessible space in Aotearoa's largest city. In 2016, real estate agents still simply did not know what accessible meant or means. Time and time again, we were shown spaces with stairs in the entrance, no accessible loos, or nowhere to enable safe drop-offs and pickups for staff and clients of all abilities. Yet again, I refused to let us be the disability organisation out the back, behind the rubbish bins or in some grim and depressing afterthought of a space. We had to embody and reflect the future we believed in so wholeheartedly. We had to manifest what was possible. At the 11th hour, we finally found what we were looking for. It was an extraordinary space in Surrey Crescent in Auckland that had been the home of a design agency. How synchronistic, given the direction we were soon to head in. It was gold. It was also nearly 3 times the price of our previous office space. I saw this as the price of an inaccessible world. I even offered to contribute part of my own salary towards offsetting this expense because I felt so sure we had to take this space. We needed to be set up for success. The fact is, there is a cost to being an inaccessible society, and someone always ends up paying for it, one way or another. 9 times out of 10, it is the access citizen or the access community. I now believed it was time we, society, started to quantify and offset this true cost. And I do not just mean financially. I was saying no to the status quo. These days, people often talk about disruption as if it is something cool or fashionable. But in my experience, true disruption is often painful, often brutal, and even life-changing. Most people actually try to avoid it. What often gets called disruption isn't. Marketers water this term down all the time. True social change is disruptive. Rosa Parks and the growth of the American Civil Rights Movement were disruptive. Nelson Mandela and the end of apartheid were disruptive. Ending discriminatory marriage laws was disruptive. The disability rights leaders in the amazing Netflix movie, Crip Camp, were disruptive. And finding genuine ways to honour Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi, in Aotearoa have been disruptive. A new chocolate bar is not. However, no matter how cool disruption can be made to sound, I now believe most people do not want disruption, especially if they are the ones who need to change in order for it to occur. The fact is that we all need to change for true access to occur. No one is exempt. And I now know in my heart that very, very few people are brave enough to stay the course as we go in and out of the fire. So coming back to work with fresh eyes, I could see as plain as day that B also needed to change. This was the inconvenient truth that I now had to convey. It is important that I clarify that when I say B was not as accessible as I now needed it to be, or believed was possible, compared to the vast majority of other organisations in our world today, we were still leaps and bounds ahead in terms of overall access. But my commitment was and is to always strive for extreme excellence in a constantly changing and evolving world. Access is not a tick box. It is an art and a way of being. As long as the world, our environment, technology, our economy, and society keep changing, access must also keep evolving. We never actually reach the end. But this message was the last thing most people at B wanted to hear. No one wanted to hear that we were not doing good enough. No one wanted to feel criticised. I now think that while one or two members of the team embraced the uncertainty, what most of the team deeply craved was stability and reassurance, familiarity and some comfort and certainty. They saw us just picking up and slotting back in where we had left off before I had taken leave 12 months earlier. While I would have loved to have been able to offer this, for me, it simply was not possible. It was directly at odds with what I knew in my heart and soul was needed for us to be an authentic champion and pioneer of access. I knew we needed to dramatically evolve. My need to deepen our approach to advancing access and the team's need for stability to enable them to do their jobs were now seriously at odds. And what's more, the world we all lived in was now also rapidly changing. Nothing was as it had been. We could not go backwards, we could only go forward into an uncertain future, and we were now all living in a very complex world. I felt it was critical we now carefully paid attention to the changing trends and global factors impacting on all of us. Back in 2008, when I had been at council, when the early seeds of what was to become B Accessible were being cultivated, we had looked at what Auckland needed to ensure an accessible future. Back then, we had focused on the Rugby World Cup and the move towards becoming a super city. I was now arguing that we needed to do a much, much bigger scan of the horizon. We now needed to pay attention to the global situation in 2016, not just to the very local issues. Whether that was new technology, AI, the share economy, the emergence of organisations such as Uber and Airbnb, climate change, or rising nationalism around the world, we needed to consider how to advance access in this fast-changing world. There is an incredible futuristic film directed by the New Zealander Andrew Niccol called Gattaca. It is a powerful movie that explores the concept of accessibility and access citizens in a futuristic world. It also indirectly explores the possible impact of many of these emerging trends on that future. In this world, genetic selection is prized by the wealthy. Society does not want disabled people. Families pay a huge amount of money to ensure they get the genetically perfect baby. The poor, on the other hand, cannot afford this genetic selection, and so still give birth to imperfect babies and children. This creates a society stratified along the lines of wealth and impairments. The character played by Ethan Hawke is framed up in that society as faulty, as broken, and as disabled. As his family was poor, he was born with a congenital heart condition. In that society, everything was set against his success, and he was a second-class citizen. Yet somehow, through his extraordinary resilience and perseverance, through sheer bloody-minded determination and unwillingness to accept his place, he actually breaks out of his social class. Why I love this movie is that, for a start, it invites us to look at what type of society we are creating for the future. It asks us, why do we choose to select out imperfections in order to create the perfect human being? This is, after all, simply an advanced form of eugenics and genetic selection. No different, in fact, from the aspirations of Nazi Germany. A critical question we must therefore ask is, what are the intended and unintended consequences of removing certain genes and impairments from our population? Who do we become as a species when we choose this? And what do we lose from our humanity by doing this? Very importantly, it also explores how it is that, as humans, we time and time again place so much value on physical strength and robustness. It clearly shows us that impairment and imperfection are not only devalued, but that in this future, they are being actively and consciously designed out of the population. With this in mind, another question now also plagued me as I stepped back into B. How would I be seen and valued now that I was not only blind, but recovering from cancer and still plagued by other health conditions? What primal or deeply socially conditioned responses might this trigger in myself and in others around me? Would or could a team still respect, believe in, and trust the direction of a blind CEO, returning still battered and bruised from cancer and a myriad of other health conditions? How was my vulnerability being received and interpreted? Of course, I can now see with great clarity that what I actually stepped back into at B was the result of systemic inaccessibility. This is the reality of the disabling world we have all created as a society. The world we have all tacitly accepted and silently endorsed. This is the impact of my friend Mark Bagshaw's physical, social, and personal access factors all colliding. So although at one level I felt huge responsibility for allowing B to become inaccessible to me, I also knew this could not and did not all sit on my own shoulders, or for that matter, on B's either. This was bigger than all of us. The reality was that many of the things I needed simply did not exist in an accessible form at that time. At B, we had pioneered so much ground, and as an organization, gone into so many taboo areas that we had come up against the edges of what was currently made accessible and what was allowed to be accessible. We had blindly and unapologetically crashed through multiple glass ceilings. So in many different ways, we simply had to make do and improvise in some way. There was no choice if we wanted to make a difference, and if we were to change things for future generations. We could not wait for things to be perfect in order to take bold action. I also now know that the harsh reality for access pioneers, their teams, and their organizations is that it is impossible to come out unscathed. Despite my physical frailty and my ongoing health issues that were to plague me for the next months and years, I was now an utterly uncompromising warrior of access. This was to have far-reaching consequences for my work, my family, and yes, my friends too. It rapidly became apparent that this was a very tough gig. I was now asking my team to evolve, for want of a better expression, and to do better with access provisions. But I felt a growing resentment and resistance from some people as I started to ask for my needs and B's needs to be properly met. At crucial moments, I felt and experienced from key people, including at times other access citizens, a mixture of deeply undermining and patronizing behavior, a degree of sexism, as well as what I now call withholding. Withholding, or the holding back of with, and trying to prevent the birth of a different future, is what happens when anyone chooses not to give generously of themselves to advance access. It reinforces a disabling society, physically, socially, and personally. It stops us from being with an individual or a group who is advancing social change. It may not be clearly visible discrimination as such. It may be what some call microaggressions, but I call it withholding. It is an energy, and I can now sense it at 100 paces. It is usually activated by fear and/or ignorance and an unwillingness to change or to go without. It can also be linked to a clash of differing and/or often unexpressed needs. At its worst, it comes out of mean-spiritedness, arrogance, or simply out of ego and extreme self-centeredness. It happens when we are no longer focused on birthing a fairer, more equitable world, instead making it about protecting ourselves and retaining the status quo. By getting in the way, we let ourselves become a barrier to change. Every single day, in every decision we make, we get to choose. Do we want to be with, or do we actually want to withhold? I could now clearly see this behavior from different people, the withholders, in all areas of my life. I could also see that what might appear to be the smallest act of withholding, declining to pour a cup of tea in a critical meeting, for example, or even appearing to do something kind and generous, such as dropping off food, but all the while seething with resentment, could in fact have the largest and most detrimental impact. I felt terribly alone with my new insight. No one else seemed to be able to see what I was now seeing, including others in the access space and many in my team. I also did not at the time have the words to describe my new insight. This made me increasingly unable to voice what I was observing, what I was experiencing, and what I now sensed was missing from so much of the social change work in our world today. At the time when I needed to be heard, I fell increasingly silent and silenced. The ground had well and truly shifted. Who would now be able to be with me in this emerging future? Who would step forward? And who, just as importantly, would now need to step back?
I do so hope you enjoyed listening to my book and podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. Listen out for the next chapter coming soon. If you would like to purchase the entire book in audio or an array of other accessible formats, including New Zealand Sign Language, or to learn more about my work, visit my website, minib.co.nz. Thank you for taking the time to listen and to be with me. See you next time. With love, Minnie B.